Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the international community is discussing additional sanctions on Russia for its land grabs in Ukraine. Speaking in London today, Kerry said the U.S. and its allies are not going to go along with what he said was Russia's extraordinarily craven behavior.
We are talking about additional sanctions, additional efforts. I'm confident that over the course of the next days, people are determined to make it clear we're not going to play this game. We're not going to sit there and be part of this kind of extraordinarily craven behavior at the expense of the sovereignty and integrity of a nation.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko accused the Kremlin Friday of direct involvement in the sniper deaths of anti-Russian protesters last year in Kiev. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the accusations ravings and madness. The top nuclear officials of Iran and the U.S. are in talks on Iran's nuclear program for the first time today, giving an extra emphasis to efforts to reach a deal by a March 31st deadline. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization Chief Ali Akbar Salehi and U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz are in Geneva for negotiations. Their presence is expected to help resolve technical issues in the way of an agreement between Iran and the six world powers known as the P5+1. Brand new U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says he wants to assure a lasting accomplishment in Afghanistan, speaking from that country on an unannounced visit.
Our priority now is to make sure this progress sticks. That is why President Obama is considering a number of options to reinforce our support for President Ghani's security strategy.
Carter commenting at a news conference shortly after arrival today. This is VOA News. A terrorist attack on a hotel in Somalia's capital that killed as many as 25 people is causing renewed security concerns in that country. While the government hopes to mobilize Somalis to join forces in rebuilding the country, the militant Islamic group Al-Shabaab continues to stage attacks in Mogadishu and elsewhere. Zlatika Hoke has the story.
Government officials were meeting at the central hotel in Mogadishu for Friday prayers when two bombs exploded and gunfire erupted. Somalia's deputy prime minister was wounded in the attack.
We are sorry because we have lost two Somali parliament members and civilians who had come to pray.
Somalia-based militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab claimed the twin bombings, saying it was targeting apostates. The attack is a new blow to the government's efforts to contain the deadly insurgency by the Al-Qaeda-linked group. Despite the recent loss of key strongholds, Al-Shabaab continues to stage attacks in the capital and elsewhere in an effort to create an Islamic State. Larissa Hope, VOA News, Washington.
Aides to former Yemeni President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi say he has left the capital Sana'a after Shiite rebels let him go following weeks of house arrest. The aides told reporters today Mr. Hadi is headed to his hometown at the southern city of Aden. He had been under house arrest after being detained last month along with his ministers when Shiite Houthi rebels toppled Yemen's government. Yemen has been in political turmoil since the rebels took over Sana'a in September. Greece has reached a deal with its creditors to ease its economic hardships. Henry Ridgewell in London has details on that effort.
Eurozone finance ministers agreed to extend financial aid to Athens by 4 months, lifting for now the threat that Greece would run out of money within weeks. Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis said it was the first step on a long journey.
We have found partners amongst those who, up until very recently, looked at us with suspicion.
Chairman of the Eurogroup, Jerome Dijsselbloem, said the deal would not allow Greece to immediately start reversing austerity measures. The deal will only be ratified once Greece's creditors are satisfied with a list of reforms to be submitted by Monday. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Fire in one of the world's tallest buildings in Dubai sent people scrambling for safety today. The flames were shooting out of the 70-story Marina Torch building when firefighters arrived at the scene. All right, so Jamie Boyd's not going to be heard from. There were no immediate reports of casualties. The cause there is under investigation, but they said it actually did look like a torch from a distance. I'm Marty Johnson reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The Independent Electoral Commission of Lesotho is so ready and is at the stage where on this Saturday, the 21st, we are going for advance voting.
Lesotho begins advance voting today ahead of the upcoming February 28 general election. We'll have details.
We are not surprised by what the utterances of His Majesty. It shows that he is suffering from denialism.
And Swaziland King Eswati III blames pro-democracy groups for tarnishing the image of the country abroad. Who have a reaction?
They haven't been given those conditions whereby they can do whatever they want with the wealth of Zimbabwe, and they haven't been a reversal of the empowerment that President Mugabe has done.
And Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe turns 91 today, but some Zimbabweans plan a series of demonstrations to pressure him to step down. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Independent Electoral Commission, IEC, of Lesotho says a cross-section of citizens will participate in a planned advance voting on Saturday ahead of the February 28 general election. Lesotho's electoral law stipulates that security forces, nurses, media houses, embassy officials and officers from the Electoral Commission who will be on duty on election day are permitted to vote ahead of a scheduled general election. Tor Hansi is the spokesman for the electoral body. He told me earlier that the IEC is ready to conduct a transparent and credible poll.
The Independent Electoral Commission of Lesotho is so ready and is at the stage where on this Saturday, the 21st, we are going for advance voting. All is in place. The material has just ready to head on to the stations where the voting is going to take place, the main one on the 28th. The politicians, all stakeholders are now together. We see to it that we are having a successful elections on the 28th.
So with the advance voting, who are those who will have the privilege to participate in this advance voting? What is the criteria?
The law provides that the security forces, nurses, media houses and electoral commission officers who will be on duty on the election day, that means on the 28th, are the ones that are allowed by the law to make applications so that they vote in advance. Even those who are at embassies, foreign, outside the countries, on embassy missions.
Well put. Let me ask you, there are concerns about ongoing tension within the country. Do you think the Independent Electoral Commission of Lesotho will have the conducive atmosphere to administer a credible vote devoid of this tension that is ongoing that some people say could undermine the credibility of the vote?
That is so true. But as for the preparations, nothing is hampering them. But anyway, I can 100% say maybe the tension that is between the security, basically, I can't say it will be as calm as ever, but we hope things will be sorted then. But as I'm saying, it's not as bad as one is saying, but now, it's never been like this before.
How are you coordinating with these security agencies to ensure that your preparation is not hampered by this possible ongoing tension and violence?
Most fortunately, all the security agencies, we are working together. 100%. They are always hereby. We always have meetings like now. We have been making arrangements, bilateral meetings with armed forces so that they can help with the helicopters transporting or with their aircraft. So that since we have some areas which are so inaccessible with any form of transportation except air wings. So all is in order. The Commission's relations with armed forces, it's 100%.
What about the police and other security agencies?
They are the ones that I'm talking about. All the ballot papers and all security materials as well as voting stations will be guarded by the police forces. And all the areas where we need soldiers, like I've just mentioned before, that for the airlifting aircraft, we will be using the ones from the army. That means everything is sorted to date.
Last but not the least, how has been the coordination or cooperation of political parties with your commission ahead of this election, especially when there was so much division and tension, accusation and counter-accusation leading up to the election, as well as, you know, the issues associated with campaigning ahead of the vote?
So far, so good, because the last meeting we had this month was last week, Monday the 9th, whereby all the political party leaders were represented and they came with other two members from each party. As we have 23 political parties that are running for these upcoming elections. Commission there was just to make the political parties the state of preparedness, and everyone seemed to be okay then.
Tor Hansi is the spokesman for the Independent Electoral Commission of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Swaziland's absolute monarch, King Inswati III, warned his people to protect the country from pro-democracy groups he blames for tarnishing the image of the Southern African country abroad. But Wandele Dludlu, the national coordinator for the Swaziland United Democratic Front, or SUDF, a pro-democracy group, told me that the king's accusations are unfortunate and misplaced.
Well, first we want to say we are not surprised by what the utterances of His Majesty. It shows that he is suffering from denialism. We live in a global village. It is not possible to keep hiding the shenanigans of His Majesty. So we believe that he is denying the reality that he is the cause of the main problem that continues to paint this country negatively out there by refusing to democratize, respect human rights, respect the rule of law. These are the things that just cascade negatively for the country out there.
Some of your supporters have expressed concern that the latest pronouncement of the king could mean that permits for demonstrations would be denied. Security agencies could use force to prevent demonstrations, among other things. What are you going to do about this latest development and concerns being expressed by your own supporters?
Definitely, I would agree with anybody who says His Majesty is taking a more tougher stance on demonstrations, on dissidents, as he calls us. I think going forward for us, first and foremost, we will continue to do our best to mobilize Swazis to continue protesting. But I think we are making a call, because these utterances are educative enough for the world to see what type of a leader and leadership is in Swaziland, to do more to hold His Majesty accountable on human rights, on rule of law, and of course, respecting a lot of these international yardsticks to which Swaziland is a signatory too. Because in our view, His Majesty will continue to posture so bad as he does if many governments in the world continue to treat him with white gloves, continue to trade with Swaziland without taking good look at the human rights record of Swaziland. Because there are no consequences on the part of His Majesty for all these atrocities that he continues to subject to us on the ground.
The king says your group and other pro-democracy groups in the kingdom are to blame for depriving the nation of key benefits that could contribute significantly to both sustainable development and social welfare programs in the kingdom. What do you say to that?
Surely it's a flawed. It's a flawed analysis. It's a flawed position on the part of His Majesty. He is the one whose government has not honored the five benchmarks required by AGOA in trading with the U.S. government, which has led, for instance, as we speak, to 17,000 Swazis losing their job. It is His Majesty who has been behind that. It is His Majesty who has been detaining, arresting, for instance, Mario Masuku, the president of PODEMO, Maxwell Dlamini, the Secretary General, Thulani Maseko, the human rights lawyer, Peggy Makhubu, who is serving 2 years behind bars. He is king who arrested these people last year in May. It's not the pro-democracy forces. It's not the pro-democracy forces who are corrupt. They in who are squandering, at least even according to their own admission, nothing less than 80 million per month in an economy so small. All these are misdoings of His Majesty. So he cannot shift blame, and he can't play a brave game. He has to sober up and get old and face the reality of democratizing this country and allowing it to flourish and be one of the prosperous countries in Africa as it should.
Wandile Dludlu is the national coordinator for the Swaziland United Democratic Front, or SUDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabani. A new initiative has been launched to increase food security for smallholder farmers in 5 regions in Ghana. The initiative, called ICT Challenge, is a partnership between Grameen Foundation Farm Radio International and Digital Green. Hilary Miller-Wise is the Chief Executive Officer for the Overseas Grameen Foundation's portfolio in the Africa region. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached her in the Ugandan capital Kampala to find out more about this initiative.
What we're focused on is increasing food security for smallholder farmers in Ghana, using a number of different channels to be able to reach the farmers with vital information that they need in order to drive productivity and ultimately increase incomes. So we'll be working together to develop mobile applications, to leverage radio and video, to be able to reach farmers in 5 regions in central and southern Ghana.
This is a unique marriage of technology and traditional farming. Why choose Ghana, and are there plans for you to expand to other parts of the continent?
It is a unique partnership. Typically, organizations will tend to focus on their individual strategies, whether that's mobile or, in the case of farm radio, obviously using the radio channel. We saw a real opportunity for the 3 organizations to come together to really leverage the expertise that each one brings to the table to be able to reach as many farmers as possible in Ghana. The idea being that while mobile penetration is quite high in many of the countries that we work in, and especially in Ghana, about 60% of the population actually owns mobile phones, which is about 15 or 16 million people. Once you get into rural areas, the mobile penetration can be quite spotty, both in terms of ownership as well as access to a signal. So we felt it was important to be able to create multiple channels to reach the farmers, which is why we were interested in partnering with Farm Radio International and Digital Green. The objective is to work through existing networks of players who are providing extension services already and be able to really amplify the extension services that they are providing by using these different channels. So once we prove the model in Ghana, we absolutely have the intention of being able to expand to other countries that would have similar conditions in terms of the reach and access of these channels, the networks of partners that are providing extension services or that have incentives to reach smallholder farmers with the kind of information that's going to drive productivity.
What timeline are you looking at to see whether your project in Ghana is bearing fruit for you to be able to expand it?
The project in Ghana right now, we are looking at a 2-year time horizon. 2 years is really not a long time to be able to develop these models and to be able to learn. Our hope is that we'll be able to continue it for 1 to 2 years after that so that we can continue to learn and iterate. We know that with the kind of innovation that we do, there is a need for continuous learning and innovation, and that often takes time. So our hope is that we'll be able to continue to operate with the commercial partners in Ghana for several years. That will allow us to then look outside of Ghana to identify other markets where we could take these solutions and really have a strong fact base to be able to replicate a proven solution.
That was Hilary Miller-Wise, Grameen Foundation CEO in the Africa region. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe turned 91 years old today, but opponents at home and abroad plan to organize a series of demonstrations to call on him to step down and hand over power. Dan Moyo is one of the organizers of the protest here in the nation's capital, and he joins us live via telephone link up. Hello, Dan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Dan, why do you want President Robert Mugabe to step down?
Well, there's a couple of reasons why. One, first and foremost, we think that he has overstayed his welcome. He has been in power for the past 35 years. We have seen no progress in Zimbabwe. Instead, we've seen a deterioration of...
Wait a minute, Dan. He was just re-elected legitimately in Zimbabwe, wasn't he?
The legitimacy is questionable. As you know, the biggest opposition party in Zimbabwe, the Movement for Democratic Change, did not concede those elections because there was massive rigging at those elections.
Well, but international poll observers, including local ones, described the elections as credible despite isolated incidents of what they call voter irregularities that did not really undermine the credibility of the vote. Their words, not mine.
The U.S. State Department, the European Union, and other progressive nations have not endorsed the election in Zimbabwe due to the irregularities. So the local people you mentioned are hand-picked by Mugabe himself to observe those elections, and they are bound to sing for their supper.
Well, SADC did the same thing, but can't you wait until the next election to marshal forces to challenge him?
No, we cannot wait for the country while it is deteriorating at the rate that it is. Unemployment is sitting at 90%. Poverty is all over. The country is portal ridden. People are dying of communicable diseases that could have been long eradicated. People are dying on the roads because there's no infrastructure development. We cannot wait another day for Mugabe to continue in power.
Well, his supporters are saying he should hand over to whom? Since it appears that there is no credible opposition to stiffly challenge him in the polls.
There is a very credible challenge in Zimbabwe. The Movement for Democratic Change under President Morgan Tsvangirai is the largest party in Zimbabwe in terms of numbers. They won in 2008 by a majority, and they won the presidency, but Mugabe refused to step down and instead forced a runoff where he then invoked violence on members of the opposition party, which caused Morgan Tsvangirai to pull out of the race.
No, but Morgan Tsvangirai himself lost the election. Initial polls showed that he couldn't, challenge President Mugabe during the poll because he did not campaign enough. He felt he could have beaten President Mugabe, but he did not put in the groundwork. Now, there is simmering tension within his own party. They appear to be a splinter group. Don't you think that this culminated in his defeat at the polls?
Tsvangirai never lost the elections to Mugabe. You can ask any Zimbabwean and they will tell you that. He has always beaten Mugabe in the elections. It's just that the elections in Zimbabwe are not free and fair. Opposition parties are denied the voters' role. Opposition members are intimidated. Opposition members are tortured. Opposition members are killed. There is no legitimacy in an election process in Zimbabwe. In fact, we have encouraged Morgan Tsvangirai not to participate in sham elections in Zimbabwe anymore. Rather, that we should take to the streets and demand justice that Mugabe must go.
Well, what do you think that will achieve? Since demonstrations have been held all over, including in Zimbabwe, in Bulawayo, in Harare, and other places, but nothing appeared to have changed. So what is different this time?
What is different this time is that the people are fed up, and also we have seen that well-coordinated efforts can bring down a regime. We've seen that with the Arab Springs. We know that if the people are united and they stand together with one voice, then they can bring Mugabe down. It is the only way we can do it. We've seen it happen in Egypt. We've seen it happen in Tunisia. We've seen it happen in Burkina Faso, and we'd like to see it happen in Zimbabwe. We want the Zimbabwean people to stand strong and demand democracy and freedom.
Do you have the structures on the ground to be able to do this? Because apparently the ZANU-PF, the ruling party, has significant structures that thwart some of these demands that you're making.
ZANU-PF does not have support from the people. It has support from institutions that it has put in place to maintain its power. ZANU-PF rules by decree. ZANU-PF uses the military, the police, in a partisan way to deny political space to opposition parties. It is now up to the people power, the masses themselves, to stand up to the dictatorship and demand that Mugabe must go.
Well, thank you very much. Dan Moyo is an organizer of one of the demonstrations calling on Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe to step down. He joined us live via telephone link up here in Washington, D.C. The European Union has renewed until February next year targeted sanctions against Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe and his wife Grace. Farai Muguwu is a political analyst and director for Center for Natural Resource Governance in Zimbabwe. He told VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7 service reporter Jonga Kandimiri that the EU should have lifted the sanctions, saying the measures are doing little, if anything, to put pressure on Mr. Mugabe.
The European Union does not like someone who tell them the hard facts they are in their face. So they try by all means to frustrate President Mugabe and to keep him at bay, but because he's the only leader in the world who can tell them right in their face to stop all the injustices that they do against other nations.
So the 28 member states have actually indicated that they carried out a review, and after everything was done and taken into account Zimbabwe's political developments, they are saying nothing has changed to merit a final lifting of restrictions. So what's the meaning of this?
They haven't been given those conditions whereby they can do whatever they want with the wealth of Zimbabwe, and they haven't been a reversal of the empowerment that President Mugabe has done, because what they want is they do not like the majority to be empowered. They want to own the resources. They want to own the land. So as long as that is not reversed in their favor, they still don't consider it a positive move, which in essence is what exactly the people of Zimbabwe are against, because they like the empowerment that that President Mugabe has done to his people. And, well, I don't think the EU really has any impact on Zimbabwe.
Why do you think the EU should actually lift these sanctions?
It's because they want resources in Zimbabwe. That is why we saw in the past week they were coming to negotiate for business deals, and they were coming with some investment packages. So they need Zimbabwe, and they must therefore amend their relations with President Mugabe.
That was Farai Maguwu, a political analyst and director for Center for Natural Resource Governance in Zimbabwe. He spoke with VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7 service reporter Jonga Kandimiri from Mutare.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting February 2nd, we'll begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Yeah, me holiday. It's just easy, baby. Johnny leave me for Lucinda. And I don't know what to do. And he talks say I know do one. Like the way Cynthia they do. Johnny give you a belle. He talks say you want marry Nene. Walk him Kedi Meneme. Johnny Mo, Johnny Mo. I'm looking for my Johnny. If I know see my Johnny, looking for my Johnny, I'm looking for my honey. You're telling me this, you're telling me that. I say this is not for me. Johnny do me corny, Johnny do me corny. He's doing me this, he's doing me that, but I know what's him on me. He go Canada, he go Tokyo. Yesterday he say he de Morocco, he dance the sicko, he sing a willow. Na lie, na lie, na Pinocchio.
Show you the money, baby, dance for me. tell me about you. Oh, don't go for you. African, 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 baby. Ooh, yeah. See, African, 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 baby. I don't, yeah. The money too much, I'm dashing. Are you feeling my singing? Like whatever you're thinking. Can't you see what I'm feeling? Lagos to Dubai. Abuja to Mozambique. Go back to Mumbai. Now we see music that want to dance to. Are you gonna dance to? If I show you my money. Are you gonna dance to? If I show you the way. Are you gonna dance to? If I show you my pockets. Baby, are you gonna dance to? If I show you my wallet. I will show you the money. Baby, dance from you. Baby, move from you. Don't go from you. I will show you the money. I will. Baby, dance from you. Show me your body. Don't go from you. Me, 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 money, mo. Baby, give me all your loving. You need me, need money more. I don't go take your love for granted. Baby, baby, fire, go, Joe. Baby, you and I just they go. Don't let bad man stop our flow. Baby, make we just they go. The money too much, I'm dashing. Are you feeling my singing? Like whatever you're thinking. Can't you see what I'm feeling? Lagos to Dubai. Abuja to Mozambique. Go back to Mumbai. Now with the music that want to dance to you. Are you gonna dance you? If I show you my money. Are you gonna dance you? If I show you the way. Are you gonna dance you? If I show you my pocket. Baby, are you gonna dance you? If I show you the wallet. I will show you the money. Baby, dance from you. Baby, move from you. Don't go from you. I will show you the money. I will, baby, dance from you. Show me your body. Don't go for you. I will show you the money. Baby, dance from you. Baby, move from you. Don't go for you. I will show you the money. I will, baby, dance from you. Show me your body. Don't go for you.
Okoko Bioko. MC Galaxy. One hand on your waist, one hand on your chest. That's the second.
the second. Move your body. Touch the second. Oh yeah, second, second. Second, second, second.
Body. Body. Oh, move body. Make you ring alarm. Oh, yeah, shake body. Coupe de calema, sagacité, équilibré, paro de ma, décalé, décalé, cricata, 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 pam, pam. So munto, calopere, calopere. All the blessings and love I deceive, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? I say all the blessings and love I deceive, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? They hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. They won't hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. Oh yeah, shake body. Oh yeah, move body. Make you ring alarm. Oh yeah, shake body. On now. I'm the man of the year now. And my music they blow everywhere now. All the way from KD. The whole world now just they hear me. My haters just they hear me. And nobody feed that would hear me. All the blessings and love I they see, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? I say all the blessings and love I they see, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? They hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. They won't hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. Oh yeah, shake body.
What do you want from the bank?
I just say come to the bank, and I got money to throw it, so everybody who ya away, rocking the body, rocking the body, rocking the body for me, keep rocking the body for me. Here I go,
oh here I go, it's time to show me your love.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always an interesting moment. Every passing weekend, I take advantage of the opportunity to address the worldwide audience of the Voice of America. Every week, I pay close attention to headlines and see how I can derive a clear analysis of the relationship between America and Africa. In doing so, you can understand the opinions of and attitudes of Africans towards the United States. This week, there are many developments going on. And of course, American policy towards Africa is reflected by domestic politics as well as what's happening abroad. As the Nigerians inch gradually towards one of the greatest elections, maybe since the founding of that country in 1960, the United States policy towards African democracy becomes a bone of contention, primarily among Nigerians and Africans on the one hand, and significantly for many journalists, broadcasters, politicians, diplomats who are interested in political governance in Africa. Within the next couple of minutes, I'm going to identify how the points of convergence and divergence between U.S. policy towards Africa, and in this particular case, Nigeria, and African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States of America. Number one, when the Americans gained independence from England, most of these nations that exist in Africa did not exist as political entities with any meaningful relations with the American people. There are many kingdoms all over Africa, and their stories are told now only in history books, but they had no meaningful relationship with the United States except for the slave trade which was going on. Now, you go 300 years later, you have in Africa as many states are the states of the Union. But their relationships in Africa is radically different from the states that emerge out of the United States. So the question of political leadership, political governance, becomes very relevant. If you are looking at it from the point of view of the United States, you can see that during the Cold War, Nigeria was one of the big crises in that war. Nigerians were never attracted by the communist movement, so Nigeria was not to be lost by the U.S. But in this particular moment in history, American policy in Nigeria revolves around a number of issues. Number one, the stability of the world market and the manner in which Nigeria could be an important partner in world politics and world history. So the Nigerian leaders have a responsibility to demonstrate beyond reasonable doubt that they themselves can govern their own country. There's a big debate in the internet among Nigerians, bloggers, journalists and writers debating about America's policy towards Nigeria. There are some Nigerians out of self-interest who like to implicate Nigerian American leaders as wooing and fighting for one party against the other. Whatever argument is made, these are just speculations. There is no evidence that any political leader who is running for leadership in Nigeria is supported by the American leadership. They are watching. The American leadership are watching. Now, if some of the Nigerian politicians try to convince all the Nigerians that they are being supported by the U.S. government, that's a lie. It's a lie. It's a lie. There is no support for any of them. What the American people would like to see, whether they are Republican or Democratic Party leaders, they want to see that there is free and fair elections in Nigeria, and the Nigerians are able to select their own leaders, and whoever is elected can come here next time around when we have another summit with the Africans. Whoever is elected by the Nigerians will be respected by the American leadership as the voice of the Nigerians. There are many Nigerians in the diaspora here in the United States. They should not send any signal back there that the government of the United States is supporting party A or B. There are individual politicians who have their own interests, and some of them are lobbyists. They can do this for their own interests. But this is not an official policy that is supported by the Congress of the United States officially. Nigeria has embassies in Washington like all other embassies. So Nigerian leaders who are here represent their country, and they cannot tell anybody else that the U.S. government supports one party against the other party. You want to have elections, the elections should take place, and the question of Boko Haram becomes a big issue for the Americans because that's a terrorist organization. There are debates among Nigerian intellectuals and politicians as to how that organization is being viewed in the United States. Boko Haram is a terrorist group. It is a Nigerian terrorist group. The Nigerians have to deal with it. If it has any international consequences, we will deal with them that way. The second point that has to be understood now, when we look at U.S. policy towards Africa, you look at how the African countries can organize themselves to deal not only with terrorism wherever it is on the continent, but trade. That's one of the reasons why the big debate against AGOA and the Millennium Forum become very important issue in American relations with Africa. And that's the way it is today until the elections in Nigeria.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, never design your character like a garden where anyone can walk. Design your character like the sky where everyone aspires to reach. I'm your host, Peter Clotta, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Illicit trafficking in wildlife, wildlife parts and products is big business, with conservative estimates placing it at $8 to $10 billion a year. Conducted by sophisticated transnational organized crime syndicates, and in some cases militant groups, it poses an increasingly serious threat to regional security and stability, and undermines decades of conservation efforts, the rule of law, and the sustainable livelihoods of communities. Given that the United States is one of the largest demand markets for illegal wildlife products, and in some instances a transit country for such products to Asia, the United States government has just released an implementation plan for galvanizing action in support of the U.S. National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking. The implementation plan is to build upon the national strategy's three main objectives: strengthening enforcement, both domestically and globally, reducing demand for illegally traded wildlife, and increasing international cooperation. One of the major issues when dealing with wildlife trafficking on a global scale is that most countries have yet to treat wildlife crime as a serious crime, develop and enforce strong criminal laws and stiff penalties against trafficking in wildlife, nor do countries possess adequate enforcement capacity to investigate and enforce such laws, nor a robust judicial system to successfully fight the corruption and illicit flow of money associated with wildlife crime. So the United States government will support partner countries in building their law enforcement and criminal justice capacities. We are also aggressively working to reduce demand for illegally traded wildlife by raising public awareness and the impact from wildlife trafficking, both in the United States and abroad. We will work to catalyze political will and mobilize support globally for these goals to encourage strong participation from our partners in the fight against wildlife trafficking. We will work to strengthen the implementation of international agreements that protect wildlife and cooperate with our partners to develop and implement innovative and effective approaches to stemming wildlife crime. The entire world has a stake in protecting the world's iconic animals, wrote President Barack Obama last February in his introduction to the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking. And the United States is strongly committed to meeting its obligation to help preserve the Earth's natural beauty for future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.